You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 31st of December, 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Matt, good day, sir. Did you have a good Christmas and a happy new year for tomorrow as well? How are you doing?
Yes, I did. For the first time in a long time. It's going to be a good year. I just got back from New York a couple of hours away, and I got into not one, but two fights with people over the mask. And then someone ran a stop sign and almost ended me for good. So there's something wrong with people up in the Buffalo area, I would say. But otherwise, things are going more or less well.
You hooligan, Matt, getting into fights over masks. That's not very becoming behavior for a priest. Getting into fights, I never would have thought that of you. Of course, I know you wouldn't actually get into any physical fights. So it's interesting, good to see that you're actually standing up for liberties there. We're going to be talking today about America's interference in Tibet. And I find this particularly interesting. You did a podcast on this yesterday, and I've read a couple of books actually on Tibet by L.A. Waddell. He was the British spy that was tasked with finding out more about what was going on in Tibet before the Russians went in there. And the Tibetans really took a liking to him, actually. They thought that he was a reflex of the Buddha, they actually said that he was, which meant that he was an incarnation of the Buddha for the West. And he investigated the Tibetans and he investigated their Buddhism. And he said that it really isn't that old. It's one of the most recent Buddhisms that there actually is, and they didn't learn to read until about the 12th or the 13th century. So all their scrolls really don't go back that far. He was really quite disappointed in them, and you contrast that with today, where we have Hollywood bending over backwards for the Dalai Lama and making him out to be some religious genius. And according to L.A. Waddell, it was really just a barbaric superstition. And he also talked about how the Chinese actually confirmed the Dalai Lama, which is rather interesting because today we find out that America wants to sanction China if they go ahead and do the same. US President Donald Trump signed into law on Sunday the historic Tibet Bill. US Congress had passed this bill on December 21st. The Tibetan Policy and Support Act, which supports Tibet in key areas, even including possible sanctions against Chinese authorities, should they try to appoint the next Dalai Lama themselves, and calls for building an international coalition to ensure such appointment is only carried out by the Tibetan Buddhist community. The bill has bipartisan support and demands Beijing allow Washington to set up a consulate in the Tibetan capital of Lhasa. Finally, it has safety provisions regarding the Tibetan environment, calling for greater international cooperation to monitor this issue besides providing funds. The Act also allocates $6 million for Tibetans living in India and $3 million for Tibetan governance, as well as $575,000 for scholar exchange programs, $675,000 for scholarships, and $1 million every year for the special US coordinator on Tibet. The act also extends to Taiwan, another hot topic in the region, supporting its participation in United Nations bodies. China, of course, sees such move as interference in its internal affairs and has responded by announcing that it could start imposing visa bans against US officials. I mean, look at the audacity of this, Matt. They're sending $3 million over for Tibetan governance. The Tibetan government is funded by China. It's the autonomous province of China, isn't it? What do you make of this bill here?
Well, you know, I wonder how many laws on the American books come from bills being buried in other bills and those other bills being buried in even larger bills. This Tibet Act was buried in the coronavirus relief bill that, you know, just passed. And that was a part of the budget, the spending bill for next year that was just passed. So this thing was buried. And I wonder how this would go if it was actually debated in and of itself. Very few people even heard of this thing prior to now. But as most of us know, the Dalai Lama has been a CIA front since at least the 1960s, where he received back then about $1.5 million a year. That was interrupted for a while. And now on budget, he receives about between $250,000 and $500,000 a year personally from the CIA. That's not even hidden. That's actually in the budget. And so the entire government in exile in India is funded almost entirely by the Central Intelligence Agency. So this is a longstanding concern for the U.S. There's gold and silver and lithium in Tibet. But most importantly, it's a way to split China apart. Despite Tibet, as you know, my show yesterday has done fairly well as an autonomous part of China.
Well, it seems as if the Dalai Lama has caused quite a few problems for China. There was a renegade one about 100 years back who started up a war against his neighbors. But then before that, China was conferring on these Dalai Lamas the right to run the province, but then China was assassinating them before they could get to the age where they could actually govern the province. But that was really to do with this Chinese region who wanted to be regent. So they had all these problems between China and Tibet. But Tibet has always been a part of China, and the British actually went in there and sorted out a lot of these problems quite some time ago. And they did a treaty with the Tibet, and the treaty was with China's permission. So this shows that Tibet has always been under China. China has always had sovereignty over Tibet, and Tibet has China has always confirmed the Dalai Lama. Yet today, the Dalai Lama is seen as a separatist. In 1995, the Chinese government arrested Gidon Choki Naima, who was then aged 6, who was identified by the Dalai Lama as a reincarnation of the Panchen Lama, who is the second most important figure in Tibetan Buddhism after the Dalai Lama himself. Gedon Choki Naima remains detained by Beijing, residing along with his family in an undisclosed location since 1995. I'll just stop there, because they could have him in an undisclosed location to prevent him from being assassinated, going by all these assassinations that have happened before. But in light of this incident, there are concerns over the choice of the next Dalai Lama. The current one, Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama, is now 85 years old. From a Chinese perspective, Tibet is a domestic issue, and the current 14th Dalai Lama, exiled in India, is a separatist. The Dalai Lama, besides being a spiritual leader for Tibetan Buddhists, is the head of state of the Central Tibetan Administration in Exile, based in Dharamshala, India. US President-elect Joe Biden dreams of a great US-India alliance after the new Becker-US-India defense deal, and now such dream might become closer to reality. This new development regarding Tibet might place India in a position to be pressured to strongly support Tibet, further increasing Chinese-Indian tensions. As of now, India has its hands tied, so to speak. Should New Delhi take a clear stand on Tibet now, Chinese retaliation would be sure to follow. However, should the Quad Group, US, India, Japan and Australia, in fact become a kind of Asian NATO or something resembling it, as China fears, would India feel empowered enough to pursue such line of action regarding Tibet in the near future? For Beijing, its interests in Tibet, as well as in the South China Sea, are essential. Should New Delhi meddle in it, Beijing will retaliate. Tensions could then escalate, maybe even leading to a new Chinese-Indian war, ironically over the same border issue as the 1962 war. And we saw a while back that America was provoking tensions between China and India. This is just America's policy all through, isn't it? Is to try and stoke tensions between countries and try to cause problems for China. We've got problems in Taiwan, problems in Hong Kong. And how long will it be until you see a color revolution in Tibet then, do you think, Matt?
Well, you know, I'm not really sure. The Dalai Lama himself is a cosmopolitan, a universalist, and depending on his audience, a liberal. Now, he goes back and forth on, you know, like sexual issues, homosexuality and things like that. One day he says it's a terrible thing. The next day he says it's a good thing. Depends on his audience. He does support gay rights, transgender, all this kind of nonsense. And that's what happens when you're a client of the U.S. But I think American foreign policy for a while now, especially since China has shifted away from Marxism to some version of national socialism or socialism with Chinese characteristics, as they say, that the big weakness of China is separatism. And so places like Xinjiang and Tibet and even Taiwan, that's where the CIA has focused its money. I think the Tiananmen Square thing was an attempt at a color revolution in the late 80s. But as far as Tibet is concerned, Dalai Lama himself is talking about, you know, changing how his position is understood. It's apolitical. Technically, in India, he's not allowed to make any anti-Chinese comments, which he usually violates. He is not a separatist officially, and he's not even an ethnic nationalist. Again, that depends on his audience. It's really hard to pin this guy down. You know, he really right now is just an image that the American press and the American left love. He's like Nelson Mandela. He has one of those faces that you just want to like, and that's pretty much what he is.
Well, of course, Nelson Mandela was a terrorist as well as a fraud, and it does seem like the Dalai Lama, that they give him all this reverence and make out that he's this religious expert. But as I say, if you actually read these books that investigated Tibetan Buddhism, they said it was just barbaric superstitions. They were actually good at horoscopes, and they did actually foretell when the Chinese went in there and they lost this last Dalai Lama when he was exiled. They did actually foretell that in a horoscope, but that's about the only thing that they're known for being particularly good at. Well, Biden is expected to continue pursuing a kind of dual containment policy on both China and Russia. Nonetheless, Biden has signaled that the US under his presidency will antagonize Russia mainly, trying to isolate it from Europe as a kind of rogue state, while treating China more cordially, so to speak, as a competitor, whilst trying to forge closer ties with India and other Chinese rivals to counter Beijing. That being so, Biden would be expected to back off from some of Trump's policies regarding Tibet. However, the bipartisan support for the bill in the Congress under the guise of human rights and care for the environment narrative will pressure him into not backing off. So, as is also the case with Trump's support for Morocco, Trump's parting gift, his successor, as it has been described, Biden might find himself with his hand tied too, in a way. Once more, a US move has heightened tensions and may also have created a dilemma for all parties involved. I find it interesting here, they highlight the fact that they're doing this under the guise of human rights and care for the environment. They've been doing it under the guise of human rights for quite some years now, and now care for the environment. This is a new one, isn't it? Climate change. We have to interfere in Tibet because of climate change. What do you make of this, Matt?
I have to laugh at this author, though. You know, it's a generally good article, but referring to Joe Biden as if he has a policy on anything, or that he could point to Tibet on a map, is pretty ridiculous. He's going to go in and the deep state, you know, CIA, corporate America, they're going to be making the decisions here. Problem is that there isn't going to be a big difference between Russia and China policy, since they're allies, both by interest, to some extent by ideology, and also by treaty. And so what this seems to suggest is that the U.S. is going to try to split the two, which has been the case at least since Clinton, which I think is going to fail. The U.S. simply can't win a war against either one of these. Well, they couldn't beat Somalia, let alone China or Russia, let alone both together. I think the big threat here is the Silk Road Initiative, this multi-trillion-dollar economic development project through Central Asia that's now splitting the EU, splitting NATO, getting European investment. It's an explicitly anti-liberal project, and the U.S., as it gets more and more desperate, like any desperate animal that's cornered and wounded, is going to lash out. And whether they use human rights or care for the environment or COVID or we love the Dalai Lama or whatever agenda that they justify it, the war, I think, is going to be, if it exists, is going to be very short, and it's going to humiliate the U.S. This is an extremely dangerous game, and it's to say nothing about the fact that China and Russia own trillions of American dollars and most of the gold on the planet. So, you know, it's going to be a very short confrontation. I think to a great extent, this is mostly symbolism.
Yeah, I don't think there'll be an open confrontation. I mean, they prefer to use proxies now, don't they? We saw that in Syria. We saw that in Libya. And to an extent, we do see that now with these skirmishes between India and China on the border. Getting back to human rights here, China does have its own human rights organization, and they say that the Standing Committee of the People's Congress of the Tibet Autonomous Region have released a statement. The reincarnation system of the Dalai Lama has lasted for centuries. The 14th Dalai Lama was selected and appointed by following the same system. His appointment also gained approval from the central government, and that's obviously of China. The US's intention to interfere in the normal reincarnation procedure of living Buddhas under the pretext of human rights and religion is to cause instability in the region. I mean, we haven't really talked about that, but it is. It's interfering with religion as well, because this is part of their religious procedure, how they do this. And China has always played a large part in this. China had Buddhism before Tibet, and in actual fact, China had given up on Buddhism by the time it actually made it to Tibet. But they have still continued to look after it, and they haven't interfered with it in any way. So, you know, it appears to me that it's truthful here, what's being said here. I'm guessing it's a communist organization. Is that right, Matt? The Standing Committee of the People's Congress of Tibet?
Well, it's connected with the Chinese government, which tends to subsidize some of the monasteries there and translating Buddhist texts from all over the world and everything else. I'm not sure if Buddhism would even exist anymore over there if it wasn't for Chinese money. As you said, the Chinese themselves gave up on it. You know, it's a philosophy. It's not really a religion. It's almost a metaphysics of greater, lesser philosophical importance and significance. But yeah, this is, as you'll say here in a minute, yeah, this has been Chinese policy for a very long time. They're I think in this particular case, they're in the right.
Waddell actually said that Tibetan Buddhism, it was almost unrecognizable from the original Buddhism. And I mean, he was a real expert on the history of Buddhism. Well, let's have a look at see if there's any truth to what China is saying here. In the Yuan Dynasty, 1271 to 1368, the central government established the Supreme Control Commission of Buddhism, later renamed the Commission for Buddhist and Tibetan Affairs, and set up in Tibet the chief military command to directly manage the region's political and military affairs. So we've got 800 years ago, and that must have been right about the time that they actually decided to become Buddhist, 1271 to 1368. The Ming Dynasty, 1368 to 1644, generally followed the Yuan administrative system for Tibet. The Ming court conferred the titles Prince of Dharma and Imperial Empowerments Master upon religious leaders in Tibet, and economically it promoted the tea horse trade to increase Tibet's trade and exchange with other regions. In the Qing Dynasty, 1644 to 1911, the Court of Tribal Affairs took charge of Tibetan affairs. In 1653 and 1713, the Qing emperors conferred the Dalai Lamas and Panchen Adinis of the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism that appeared in the late Ming Dynasty and established the system of lot drawing from the golden urn to confirm the reincarnated soul boy of a deceased living Buddha. Interesting, it was China that actually established the system of lot drawing from the golden urn. In 1751, Emperor Qianlong appointed the 7th Dalai Lama to administer the local government of Tibet and established the Kashag, the cabinet, composed of four kalons or ministers. In 1793, ordinance by the Imperial House concerning better government of Tibet, the so-called 29 Articles, was promulgated to enhance the King Court's administration of Tibet. The central government continued to exercise sovereignty over Tibet during the Republic of China period, 1912 to 1949. In 1940, the nationalist government set up the Tibet Office of the Mongolian and Tibetan Affairs Commission in Lhasa. The organic law of the Congress of the Republic of China stipulated the methods whereby the people of Tibet would participate in elections and the rights of elected congressmen from Tibet to directly participate in deliberation and administration of state affairs. The identification and enthronement of both the 14th Dalai Lama and the 10th Panchen Adini were approved by the government of the Republic of China. And as I pointed out earlier, they were allowed to, they did have the administration of these state affairs. It was only taken away from one Dalai Lama because he went and made war against all his neighbors. So they had to strip him of administration. And apparently he was also abusing his people there. Have you got any comments to make on this potted history we have here, Matt?
Well, this is a very brief summary. This is more or less the official Chinese position. It has been since the High Middle Ages. I mentioned this briefly in my talk yesterday. And it shows that the entire purpose of this bill that Trump signed, that no one heard of until the other day, is ridiculous, because it says China can't interfere with the selection of the Dalai Lama, which is another way of saying they want to appoint the Dalai Lama themselves, despite the fact that at least since the Ming Dynasty, not only have the Chinese appointed him, but all of his ministers. Chances are Buddhism itself came from China. The entire organization of the economy, the way that the monasteries function, ultimately was recognized, organized, and financed by the Chinese all the way up until today, with, of course, the exception of the Mao era. So the whole bill is based on a kind of history that's absurd. But that's nothing new for Washington.
Well, I guess, as you say, the current Dalai Lama is a CIA asset, and obviously they want the next one to be a CIA asset as well. So they want to pick which one it's going to be. Well, let's have a look at what China themselves say about this. They say this year marks the 69th anniversary of the peaceful liberation of Tibet. The autonomous region has made great progress in its human rights cause over the past 69 years. After achieving peaceful liberation, Tibet introduced a democratic reform which enabled 1 million serfs to enjoy human rights and established the system of regional ethnic autonomy. The region has achieved rapid economic and social development, sustaining double-digit GDP growth for more than 20 consecutive years. The average life expectancy of people in Tibet has risen from 35.5 in 1951 to 70.6 years. So they've actually managed to double the life expectancy. And I can remember reading elsewhere that these monks there, that they were involved in usury, and it was a really bad system that they had, and that the serfs were really treated very badly. They were treated as peasants. So it could be that they were being liberated from. What do you know about this liberation, Matt? Is that what was going on? Was it usury that they were liberated from?
Well, this is an official statement that you just read that I had here. Certainly it wasn't peaceful. That's almost like, you know, an official slogan. This brought Tibet under the Maoist system. And at least to their credit, though, you have, again, in another official publication, it says, and I'm quoting here, there have been twists and turns in the ultra-left attempts to force the pace of change with the Cultural Revolution from 66 to 76, inflicting extensive and grievous damage on life, the economy, education, religion, cultural heritage in Tibet, as in the rest of China, which is a condemnation of Mao from the official party, a party organ. So they're aware that Mao's collectivization and everything else was very destructive in Tibet. There's no question about it. And that proves how China has changed so radically since that era. But the official party line is, and there's probably some truth to this, they were liberated from oligarchy and usury. This wasn't the good kind of serfdom. This was a bad kind of serfdom. And on the other hand, they were liberated from, to a great extent, British imperialism. Those are the two things that they claim to have liberated Tibet from.
So the peaceful is as in peaceful protest, or mostly peaceful protests, so like the ones we saw this summer when Black Lives Matter were burning down the cities. That was the sort of peaceful liberation that Tibet had. And let's have a look at some of the achievements or some of what China actually does in Tibet. Religious activities are respected and protected. Currently, there are 1,787 sites for different religious activities in Tibet and more than 46,000 resident monks and nuns. Tibet Autonomous Region and seven cities all have Buddhist associations. The Tibetan branch of the Buddhist Association of China has set up the Tibetan Buddhist Institute, the Tripitaka Scripture Printing Lamasery, and the Tibetan Buddhism Journal in Tibetan language. Tibetan and other minority ethnic groups lead their religious lives and carry out religious activities according to native traditions. In Tibet Autonomous Region, religious festivals are celebrated in the same way as they always were. And it's interesting because communism is traditionally, it's atheist, isn't it? It gets rid of religions, but it does look as if they have allowed some semblance of this to continue there. Matt, do you know much about whether it's genuine religion that they have here, or is this just something that's put on for the tourists?
Well, again, the very fact that they have this huge increase in tourists suggests that it's a peaceful place. You know, they're subsidizing the traditional what they call, you know, scriptures. You have, you know, 50,000 monastics there. These are mostly, you know, philosophical schools, more than anything else, who can be very militant and very violent, especially with each other. Buddhism is generally an atheist religion. Really, it's not a religion at all. There is no God in it. Buddha was pretty famous for saying so, at least not in any sense we would remotely recognize. But because this is so different from the philosophical Buddhism in India and even the Zen school in Japan, I don't even know. I mean, you have things like the Devil Dance Festival and the exhibition of the Sagadawa Festival and all these other things, which I'm pretty sure you're not going to find elsewhere. So these aren't just Buddhist ideas. These are traditional Tibetan ideas, which is something, of course, that Lenin and Stalin would never do in a million years, or Mao wouldn't do in a million years. So these are fairly recent developments. The point of all this is that the claim that there's cultural genocide there is false. It was under Mao, but that was genocide everywhere. But it's simply not the case. Not only are they permitting this stuff, but they're subsidizing this stuff.
Well, if you have ethnicity-specific parts of the religion there, then quite clearly the religion has been allowed to continue. More than 40 major religious activities, such as pilgrimages to holy mountains and lakes, the Sagadawa Festival, the Buddha Exhibition Festival, and the Lamaist Devil Dance Festival, are protected and inherited. Almost all religious believers have scripture halls or shrines at their homes. Every year, millions of pilgrimages to Lhasa are made. In Tibet, prayer flags and mani stones are seen everywhere. All major temples are full of believers prostrating themselves before Buddha, spinning prayer wheels and paying homage to Buddha. Tibetan people enjoy full freedom in their conduct of religious activities. To meet the religious needs of different believers, Tibet has 4 mosques and 1 Catholic church. Matt, they must have come reconciled to those missionaries that they massacred that you were mentioning in your podcast there, if they have a Catholic church here now. And also, they're saying they have these pilgrimages here, and you think, well, Tibetan Buddhism, that's just from Tibet, but it's also from Mongolia, isn't it? And isn't that have something to do with this? And Russia, the actual Tibetan religion, wasn't it originally from the Mongols, something like that?
Yeah, I mentioned yesterday that this yellow sect that is now the dominant Buddhist sect in Tibet came into existence because they were very close to the Mongol viceroys in China at the time, and they used them to crush and destroy their opposition. So that's how this entire system came into existence. It is a violent sect. The myth that Buddhism is this peaceful religion is absurd. You can't have a Buddhist empire in places like, you know, Siam and China and Burma and be pacifist. That's simply not how it works. But that's how it's been translated and manipulated to the Lululemon shoppers in suburban America.
I think Mongolia or Tatar, some part of Russia had another autonomous religious bit that was following Buddhism. That was about 100 years ago when L.A. Waddell was writing. I don't know if that has continued. But it was on the same level as Lhasa. It was just as important as Tibet at the time. So it'd be interesting to see if that's continued. Tibetan Buddhist culture is respected and protected. The central government and the local government of Tibet Autonomous Region have always regarded Tibetan Buddhist culture as an important component of traditional Chinese culture, offering protection and reinforcing the collection, compilation, publication, and research of religious classics. The central government set a budget of more than 40 million yuan for the revision and publication of the Tibetan Buddhist canons Kangyur and Tengyur, a 20-year project entailing the efforts of more than 100 Tibetan experts. Temples are maintained and protected. Since the 1980s, the state has allocated funds, gold and silver to maintain, renovate and protect temples. More than 1.4 billion yuan has been spent on restoring Tibetan cultural relics and refurbishments of key monasteries. a total of 6.7 million yuan, 111 kilos of gold, 2,000 kilos of silver, and a large amount of jewellery have been used to renovate stupas and prayer halls from the 5th Panchen Udini to the 9th Panchen Udini. The state budget to build these for the 10th Panchen Udini was 66.2 million yuan and 650 kilos of gold. In 1994, the state allocated another 20 million yuan to renovate Ganden Monastery. Since 1995, the central budget has given active support to the maintenance and protection of monasteries listed as state key cultural relics units, such as the Potala Palace, Norbalinka, and Sakya Monastery. And I find this interesting. Does the church still get money from the government in the West? I don't think it does. Does the American government pay out money like this to any of the churches in America, Matt?
No. Obviously, I'm struggling to not be facetious here. But this, such a mockery is made of all the claims that this is, cultural genocide and they're being destroyed and Buddhism is illegal there and everything else. There's a Catholic church with 400 parishioners, despite, the Catholic missionaries being slaughtered by the Tibetan lamas over 100 years ago. The amount of gold that's been – the huge investment here suggests that all of this stuff is absolute nonsense. I've always been an ethnic nationalist. I support ethnic separatism almost all the time. But in this case, number one, no government's going to do better economically than the Chinese have. Number two, they've never been independent. And number three, even within the empire, they've always been very autonomous and have had their own language and everything else, which is still being protected today. So this is not a good case of legitimate ethnic separatism. And really, number four, it's sponsored by a foreign power. So it's illegitimate. I think in this case, the Chinese are right.
It's interesting that America and the West aren't calling for the separation of church and state in Tibet, are they? Like they have over here in the West. I mean, it really is. They will just do anything that they can to subvert these other countries, no matter how they do it. In Ukraine, they'll sponsor neo-Nazis, while in the West, they'll be telling us, we can't have nationalism. Well, best of luck anyway to Tibet and to China. Let's hope that they can work out their differences. Thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Happy New Year to everyone. For tomorrow, the Daily Nationalist will be back next week. We have some Greatest Britons for you tomorrow. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.